Welcome to episode number 39 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
That's me. And our guest today is Matt Van Roon, game developer and fan-turned-archivist at Big Finish Games. Matt is here today to talk about the recovery of the original master tapes from the Tex Murphy series of adventure games, a rare video game preservation story with a happy ending. He recently posted a blog about this on the Big Finish website, but we wanted to get a little bit more in depth here. Matt, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me be straight with you. Never played a Tex Murphy game.
Good, I can admit it too.
Yeah, great. Essentially saw there was full motion video involved and was like, yeah, I get it. But maybe I don't. So tell us about the Tex Murphy series. Give us the primer here.
Sure. Well, the Tex Murphy series actually started way back in 1989 with a game called Mean Streets. And Chris Jones, who was, you know, the manager and one of the lead producers at Access Software at the time, you know, always loved cinema, making home movies and stuff like that. And then he decided, you know, with his coworkers that he wanted to make a series of adventure games, but take a far more cinematic approach. So they were actually one of the first people to integrate full motion video and animated video as well as real dialogue in adventure games. So way back in 1989, they had, you know, quite a groundbreaking approach in terms of adventure game storytelling for the PC market. But it wasn't until Under Killing Moon, which came out in 1994, thanks to the compact disc format, that they could really sort of up the ante and provide almost what they called, and it was marketed as this, an interactive movie. But unlike, you know, what a lot of people think with interactive movie, and that is straight video where you have like a choose your own adventure type, it was heavily reliant on, you know, still your adventure game point and click exploration with cinematic video to enhance the storytelling while also listing B grade, sometimes A grade Hollywood acting talent. And that's what the series is most well known for.
So you started as a fan, and now you're one of the two official archivists for the series. How did you, what's your journey, man? How did you get here?
It was a fantastic journey. So I actually started out with their game Under Killing Moon back in 1994. And, you know, this story is kind of like been told a few times throughout the adventure gaming community. But, you know, I had a high school friend of my brother's that came running home one day and he said, you know, you have to try out this fantastic new game that's just come out. It's called Under Killing Moon. It's about this detective named Tex Murphy. And it has like real actors and cinematic sequences and you could play it on your PC. And my brother and I got so excited to play this game, we went, ran out and bought it, but we didn't actually even have a PC to play it on at the time. So it would take another 2 or 3 months for us to convince our parents to buy a PC for schoolwork, of course, which happened to have the exact same system requirements as the game in question, and subsequently kind of played the game, and we got hooked on it. So at the age of 9, I started playing these games as a fan, and of course, when the internet came out in the early, mid-90s, and then things like internet forums and online communities before social media was a thing, I became heavily involved in the Tex Murphy community. And then when the series went into hiatus in 1998, after Access Software was purchased by Microsoft, they decided to do a Kickstarter to reignite the series back in 2012. And at that stage, the entire series of life choices and career choices I made were influenced by Tex Murphy. So I went into multimedia, filmmaking, programming, game design. So when they came out with a Kickstarter, I just pinged them via the community, which I'd become so heavily embedded in, and said, hey, guys, you know, you guys are the whole reason why I kind of did this as a career choice. Do you need any help? And they just said, come on over. And that's how I ended up becoming a part of the Tex Murphy series, from fan to contributor, and then now subsequently project manager and archivist.
So what is your role other than recovering tapes then? I mean, what is it that you do at Big Finish?
Sure. Well, when I came on board for the Tesla Effect game, I was the visual effects supervisor and lead VFX artist. So I did most of the compositing and the video production and the special effects, etc., for the full motion video sequences there. And then subsequently for this upcoming project, this 25th anniversary, which we'll go into more detail with regards to the archival process, I inherited the series archivist role mainly because there wasn't such care taken with regards to preserving the legacy.
Say it ain't so.
And, you know, we'll go into more details that too, but it was kind of like a self-identified, like, if I don't do this or rally the troops to do this, it's not going to get done and we're going to regret this later. And so I kind of just like bestowed that responsibility upon myself. And then subsequently through my dealings with the company as a whole, as a staffer, I picked up programming and design and level design and everything. So, you know, it's a combination. It's many hats, many of them self-allocated, to be honest with you.
The archivist hat is usually a self-allocated one in the game industry.
Oh, yes, exactly. Big time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's how the big companies do it too, right? I mean, Kelsey and I have, I think, both talked to Stefan Cerbicki at EA, and that's just how their archive team started, was that, you know, one day years ago, he was like, hey, no one's doing this. And then they were like, cool, you do it.
So. It seems like the higher up you get in the company, the less care or is given for regards to that. It takes someone who is either a fan or a player or someone who's like down in the trenches to be like, no, this has to be done. I'm putting my foot down.
And so this wasn't started at all until, you know, 2012-ish. Is that right? Like there wasn't even any sense of like, let's keep the stuff around or figure out where it is.
No, exactly. And actually quite the opposite. You know, they were extremely close to basically trashing most 90% of their archive content. And it was actually by accident that we took on this archival process, because when we were working on Tesla Effect, me and another VFX artist named Bjorn Ottesen, we would work at the Big Finish Game Studios like way into the morning. You know, it wasn't crunch time hours. It was just basically when you render a lot of scenes, you're spending a lot of time with render hours. So we'd set the computers to render, go and see a movie, set the computers to render, go and get some dinner. So we, you know, we'd already seen our fish, seen every movie at the local cinema by this stage. We'd already eaten dinner this one night. So we thought, okay, the machines are going to be processing for about 3 hours. Let's just walk around these studios and see what mischief we can get up to. So we started walking around and there was this loft space, which is like the junk space of the entire studio warehouse here at Big Finish Games. And we started looking at all these cool things like old game boxes, you know, and we stumbled across these three or four cardboard boxes that had literally been shoved in the corner and a bunch of crap stacked on top of it. And we sort of pulled off the crap and opened these boxes. And to our amazing shock and surprise, there was dozens and dozens of these tapes, different formats like beta tapes, SVHS tapes, M2 tapes, this whole thing. And when we looked at the labels, we saw on them, you know, Under Killing Moon, the Pandora Directive. We're like, holy crap, this is the legacy. Now, a quick word on that loft. This was basically a junk pile that was, you know, bookmarked for getting trashed with house cleaning. So me and Bjorn immediately just collected all these tapes. And we thought, if someone doesn't start the process of preserving these or digitizing these, they're going to walk. So we actually had some of the original hardware. We had a beta deck, we had an M2 deck. And we plugged it in with this janky, it was like some $12 cheap local computer store capture card that was USB 2 or something like that. And we plugged it all in, and that was our new rendering hours task. We'd set the machines to render, and then the next few hours we'd archive these tapes in this very, you know, not as high resolution as we wanted, interim format. So yeah, it was a complete accident. We stumbled across these tapes and decided to commence the archiving and upscaling process.
Wait, so you're a hardcore fan. You are in the fan communities for the 13 years that the series is nascent.
Yes.
And it took you how long to go digging through the boxes?
Well, it wasn't at the studio for 13.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, right. I know.
Well, and that's the thing. The question is, well, you know, nobody there at the studio like had any,
like,
care
even knew or that stuff was there.
Yeah, they didn't know it was there. And the saddest part is, so like, you know, fast forward, like, so we did the interim capturing, but in those boxes, there was only about 50% of the tapes. So, You know, just for context, the Pandora Directive, which is one of the games we're currently remastering, has about 50 or 60 tapes, which is a combination between Beta SP and M2. And we only found about 30, 32 of them in those boxes. So we captured what we had and then stored them away and sealed up the boxes and made sure we wrote big labels on the boxes like Pandora Directive, Legacy Tapes, Archive Only, blah, 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 blah. We couldn't have been any more clear. So then after Tesla Effect was released, I ended up working for another company on the East Coast. And then I actually came back to Big Finish Games a few years later. And I'd convinced Chris Jones, okay, I would love to really dig in and do a proper archival of these tapes. Can we take it to an external house that has all the right gear, well-maintained gear, and do as high resolution as possible? He said, go for it. So I went back upstairs to where the boxes were, and Pandora was still there. Overseer was still there. Underkilling Moon completely gone. It was gone. And I was just like, I went down to the warehouse and I said to the warehouse guys, yeah, you know what happened to all the stuff there? It's like, oh yeah, we did a big spring cleaning. And I'm like, And it's like, yeah, I think those ones got trashed.
Oh.
And I was just like, oh God. But, you know, luckily we actually digitized it with the interim archiving we did a few years earlier.
Oh, so there's no happy ending to that. They actually were trashed.
Yeah, they were trashed. Those particular tapes were trashed. Now I had a digitized version of it, but it's, like I said, it's an interim digitization. It's not as high quality as using an external production house. And then after that, you know, the hunt began for the remaining tapes. So we only had about 50% of the tapes. So I dedicated a whole 2 months worth of literally scouring every nook and cranny in the entire studio. And we found tapes under stairs, over ceiling tiles, in the warehouse, in crates, under people's desks.
How did they get in the ceiling?
Because what had happened was sometimes the storage closets were chocked so full that they would pop out the ceiling tiles and put more stuff above the ceiling tiles.
That is so, I mean, already I admire your optimism just for being like, yeah, there's definitely more tapes here, because I've seen enough of this that I probably would have just been like, wow, it's lucky that 50% of them were here.
Right?
Know? Not that I wouldn't have looked, but I mean, I don't know that I would have looked in ceiling tiles.
I disagree. You would have.
That's probably true.
We both would have. I mean, like, how are we on any research project? Come on.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
But, how were we at the offices of Game Informer?
Yeah, we dug through everyone's desks and under their desks. We did not look in the ceiling tiles, though.
We didn't.
And need to go back.
Oh, what did we miss?
What I'm saying. Yeah, we didn't. I'm saying we didn't look in the ceiling. So there may still be more stuff yet to find. But yeah, I mean, the fact that you're still finding things, and that at the point where the closet gets overfilled, it wasn't just into the trash with these old tapes. Someone took the time to like shove them up into the ceiling.
No, exactly. And it had gotten to the point where, you know, of the 50 or 60 or so tapes we had recovered, because they're all labeled. So at any given time, we had to consistently update what the maximum amount was. So, you know, we had up to like 42 at one point, and then we found like a 58 labeled tape. We're like, okay, now we know that there's X of 58 tapes in this deck. So the more we discovered, the more we knew exactly how many we were looking for. And I got to the point with where I had recovered, okay, under Killing Moon, notwithstanding, because that was, you know, trashed. Between the Overseer game and the Pandora Directive game, I had recovered every single tape except for two from the Pandora Directive. And I would spend the next 3 to 4 weeks just looking for those two tapes. And I went over every location again twice more and couldn't find it. And I was just getting frustrated and desperate. And I went up to Doug Vandegrift, who is one of the developers who's worked on the series since 1989 and was the kind of interim archivist at the time.
Oh, and actually, real quick before you get there.
Yeah.
Is this office location vintage as well?
No. Well, here's the thing. They have moved the office location a few times. So the one that I was looking for was not the one that they had when they worked on the games themselves.
Okay. Okay, so these were moved around, and he was the one who likely moved them and stuffed them places, including the ceiling tile. Got it.
Exactly, and stuffing them places ties exactly into the conclusion of this part of the story. So I went up to his office and I interrogated him like any detective game fan would. And I said, you know, you need
Did you try rubbing your inventory on
Right, exactly. I tried combining all these things to give to him. It's like, here, have a paper clipped. What can I do with that? So I said to him, like, Doug, help me out here. I need you to rack your brain. You were the only one who would have moved these tapes. I've checked the ceiling tiles. I've checked all this kind of stuff. And he turned to me. He's like, dude, I have no idea where these final tapes could be. And I looked around his office and I was taking a deep breath. And I look at his desk and I go, Doug. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, what are you using there to prop up your monitors? And he's like, oh, there's just a couple of old tape boxes. And I'm like, Doug, do you mind rotating them around so I could see the labels on those tape boxes?
Doug, what were we talking about 10 seconds ago?
Right. So he lifts his monitor off, turns the boxes around, and there were the two missing tapes. And I'm just like, sheer elation and joy and maddening frustration at the same time manifested itself in a series of eye twitches and dead silence. I just grabbed the tapes and I walked out of there.
So as you're talking to him about how there's two missing tapes and you're grilling him, is he behind his monitor as he's talking to you where the two missing tapes are clearly labeled in his eyesight?
Yeah, he didn't even turn around to address me. He was facing his screen, which was sitting on top of these tapes, while he was trying to tell me he has no idea where they are.
So literally, like, in eyesight are the two tapes.
Yes.
And he's like, I don't know anything about these tapes.
You can't make this up.
Oh, good God.
So, you had a line in your article there that I thought was so great. That's like, anytime someone says level design is unrealistic, that there would be tapes, you know, hidden in plain sight and in ceiling tiles and all of that stuff. It's apparently it's more likely than you think.
The pixel hunt is real. It is real.
Great. So you recover the tapes. I gotta wonder though. I mean, at this point, have you just kind of fully inventoried the archive? Do you just know everything? And did you find any other, you know, useful bits that you didn't know about, or just the tapes?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of useful things we found. A lot of them were, you know, legacy game boxes, big boxes that were, you know, many still in their original shrink wrap. Because game boxes is another thing that people are starting to collect at the moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's face it, when big boxes were in their prime and you could go to the store and buy one, you know, you took the contents out, trashed the box, whatever. It was just anything. And it wasn't until they stopped making big boxes that people were just like, I really need, as an adult now, and I can lay out my bookshelf however I like, you're like, I really miss having things to put on that bookshelf. So I found a lot of old game boxes, a lot of tapes from some of our other games as well, because Access Software was responsible for the Lynx Golf series, which had full motion video in it for the golfers and everything. You know, tapes of interviews with Arnold Palmer, all those kind of guys, and even full motion video from those earlier games like Mean Streets and Martian Memorandum, even though because of the technical limitations on the PCs at the time, it was kind of like, you know, a series of still images played to look like a filmic sequence.
Right. So remastering that would actually be crazy.
Yeah, they were actually originally recorded on SVHS. So we have a full motion version of those as well.
Wow.
So this recovery process, I mean, are there commercial projects already signed off on, or is this just, you know, on your spare time sort of thing?
So the archival process was just something that was, you know, just inherited and self-bestowed just for preservation of the series to open the doors for a potential future project. But as a fan first and a player later, it's a fan first and a contributor later.
Although you were a fan first and then a player later.
That's true.
It took 3 months to get a computer.
Exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. Spot on. So, you know, my goal, I mean, I was archiving Tex Murphy content before I was even involved in the making of the project. Like, as a fan, I would collect everything, like posters and interviews and download these things. So I had a hard drive of just Tex Murphy stuff that I collected as a fan from a distance. So when I worked for the project and realized that they themselves weren't doing anything to preserve the legacy, I went in and just basically said, no, I need to continue fanboying and finding as much content to collect as possible. And I even ended up on my own dime renting a climate-controlled storage space to put it all. So I actually have a storage space that's properly climate-controlled here in the dry Utah heat, where I have shelves and catalogs and everything of all of this content where it's preserved and stored in the right position.
Well, and this opens up just a ridiculous amount of doors for creating more legacy content. I mean, once this is all there, now all of a sudden, even if they weren't planning on doing remasters or even, I mean, even just putting some of these tapes out on YouTube or whatever, I mean, there's so many avenues now that they can take because of the work that you did. So listen up, game companies, hire your Matt Van Roon fans because they're the ones doing the real work.
Well, exactly. And it was, you know, the whole idea of potentially exploring the idea of these remasters came about because Chris Jones came into my office one day and he says, I'd like to play these Tex Murphy games for kicks just one time. So me as a fan first, the idea of playing Tex Murphy with Tex Murphy was an opportunity I could not pass up. So what we do during our lunch break for the course of about 3 or 4 weeks, we get some takeout, sit in the conference room, boot up the games on the projector there, and I'd be at the helm playing these games with Chris Jones, Aaron Connors, Doug Vandegrift, all watching as we played through it. And as the credits of the Pandora Directive in particular rolled, because we all consider that the flagship game, as they rolled, there was this lasting sentiment of, wouldn't it be cool if we could remaster that one? And I was just like, yeah, that would be cool, wouldn't it? And so, like, had they not have taken the archival or had someone come in to archive this, that never would have been an option. That simple notion just thrown out there would have been, oh, it would have been good, but the tapes are in the trash and there's no chance we can upscale old 90s 10 frames a second 256 color video to HD anymore, so it's a pipe dream. You know, had it not have been archived, that conversation would have ended with a, yeah, in another life.
So actually, you know, someone actually did do that. Are you familiar with, did you follow the Command and Conquer tape recovery process?
Yes, I heard. I didn't follow it thoroughly, but I got the, you know, bit of news bits through forum chats and social media posts.
Yeah, you got the unfortunate ending that they're gone, and you know they did have to resort to essentially upscaling, you know, the assets that were in the games at the time, and you know it looks better maybe than playing the full thing, but you can't get better than the actual raw material, and it's a little bit unfortunate that that's gone in that case.
Yeah, there's only so far the AI and machine learning can do, and what I've found with machine learning is, as brilliant as it is at upscaling content, it still relies on a very strict set of input parameters to yield a very good result. You can't just feed it, you know, I think, you know, when Yahtzee, who does the zero punctuation reviews of a lot of video games, he said it most poignantly when it comes to the quality of full motion video back in the 90s. He said, it looks like ketchup poured out to the floor of a pancake factory. is what the resolution often looked like back then. So unless you do have the original tapes, you're kind of like garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you got all the tapes recovered, digitizing most of them, didn't present any issues. You worked with a pro locally to you, I believe. But you did run into a bit of a snag with one particular format, the Panasonic M2. Mm-hmm. And I think this brings up a good discussion point about the fragility of some types of media, because this isn't a common format that your local, you know, we put your tapes on DVD house can even handle, right?
Yeah, correct. So the M2 format was Panasonic's attempt at rivaling the whole Sony Beta format. And at the time, it was fantastic. It was a nice metal tape, came in two formats, one that's like a larger VHS size, and one that's, you know, your mini M2, which is for your smaller camcorders. And when I say smaller, I mean, you know, big enough to hoist on your shoulder if you're buff enough to hoist a camera that big. But yeah, so digitizing the Beta SP was fine because Beta SP decks, even for, you know, smaller production houses, are fairly common. But the M2 format was challenging, and the production house we used a company called Video Wholesale Services in Salt Lake City, and they had virtually everything. But what they didn't have was an M2 deck. But however, we had our M2 deck, which was used on the production. So I said to them, you know, why don't I loan you the M2 deck as well as the tapes, and then you can use the rest of your gear to dub it over. And so I gave them the M2 deck, and we put the first tape in, and it was terrible news. Like, a lot of horizontal banding, shifting, time-based correction issues. You know, there were so many things wrong with the image that even when I consulted some forums like Video Help forums and Video Archivist forums, you know, forums filled with people who are used to dealing with this sort of thing.
Shout out to Digital FAQ.
Yes, exactly. You know, their response was, well, it could be a plethora of issues. And they laid out, you know, from good to bad. It's like, this is your best case scenario. This is your likely scenario. This is your worst case scenario. And it was a whole plethora of issues because, let's face it, you know, you'll never know what the issue is. You just know that there's an issue with some of these old formats.
Well, it could have been the tapes, right? I mean,
precisely, which would have been the worst case scenario, because if it's the tapes, you know, we're out of luck. And in fact, when we put the tapes in, I said, let's put another in. I was kind of hoping maybe it was isolated to one or two tapes that were stored incorrectly, but no, it was every single tape had this issue, and it was intermittent horizontal shifting. And I was so desperate to want to get it preserved that I was even contemplating frame by frame doing a shift correction on the output. And the guy said, maybe in 10 years you'll be done. I'll be like, yeah, that's not going to happen. So he came up with a brilliant idea. Mark at Video Wholesale Services came up with this brilliant idea, and he said, I have a few industry friends that may have an M2 deck. I'll call up a few favors and see what I can get. And 2 days later, a friend arrived with a higher-end M2 deck. So we put the tapes in. Now, here's the issue. The M2 decks were notorious for having a problem where most of them were designed to take both format tapes, the larger format and the smaller format. And as you inserted it, it would recognize which tape and spool it correctly. However, that spooling mechanism was notoriously bad for dying in the M2 decks. And the replacement parts for a combo spooler were almost non-existent. So every time that went out, companies, even big production houses, would replace it with a spooler that would only take the large format tapes. So this new deck that had arrived only took the large tapes, and we had a whole bunch of small tapes. So Mark turns around and he goes, well, how about I take the tape outside of the smaller shell, re-spool it into a larger format VHS tape, stick it in and see what the result's like? And I said, can you do that? He's like, yeah, sure. I mean, it's all tape, so, you know, it should be fine. So we re-spooled it into a VHS tape and we inserted it in, and it was the same problem. We had terrible horizontal shifting and banding. However, the new tape deck had more knobs, whistles, dials, everything on it. So we were able to kind of fine-tune it a little bit to the point where we could get a fairly convincing playback, but it was inconsistent. One scene would show horizontal banding that we could correct with a few knobs and settings. And then the next scene would show a different type of horizontal banding, so we'd have to adjust it. So it would have required around-the-clock supervision to get an ideal image that was maybe 50% better. And, you know, that too was not going to happen. We just weren't happy with that. And at this stage, Mark turns around and says, okay, I got one more favor to call in. I'm going to get a third deck. And I'm like, where's it coming from? It's like, I don't want to say anything yet because, you know, I don't know if I can get it. So I said, okay, you do what you got to do. 2 days later, he gives me a call. He says, I got a third deck here. I'm like, where the hell did you get it? He's like, NBC New York.
This guy's a hero.
Right? He was just as tenacious as I was. So he said, I got it. It's an old ex NBC studios. Got it shipped from Rockefeller Plaza. It's here now. Let's try it out.
Don't ask any questions.
Yes, exactly. So we got it there, and it was another deck, and same thing. Retrofit it to only accept the larger tapes. Put the re-spool tape in there. Crystal clear image, spot on, absolutely perfect, no issues whatsoever. And we found out what the problem was. Another issue with these decks, and this is a common theme here with these old tape decks, one of the things that likes to die on these decks are the time-based correction chips, these little chips that take the input feed and the digital data and just basically corrects them so that you don't get that horizontal shifting and it represents a clear image. Now, those chips were notorious for dying. The capacitors would die. So luckily, this NBC deck that arrived was so well preserved and so well maintained that its time-based correction chip didn't fail as badly as the other two. And such is the saga of the M2 tapes. They were able to be dubbed in their highest quality.
Does he still have the deck?
He kept it. He said, I'm keeping this deck. He gave me back my terrible deck. He says, you take that. And he's now got two M2 decks that he can use for his archival processes going forward. He says, I don't know if I'm ever going to get another M2 tape through this studio ever again, but if I do, I'm happy.
Well, there is currently on eBay a lot of 25 news segment tapes in M2 format from unknown broadcast source. So if he wants to digitize some old news reports in extremely high quality, there's a place for that. But the reason I actually went to eBay was to just confirm. Every deck that's on here says four parts as is.
So, yes, exactly.
This is not something one can just purchase.
And I imagine even the repair market for, you know, there certainly were people back in the day who made their living as repair technicians for this kind of technology. But I mean, that knowledge is decades old at this point. And, you know, the ability to repair this is not going to be, especially if it's an issue with a chip failing.
Oh, yeah.
That's not a part someone's going to just have on hand.
No, in fact, the solution that a lot of people even recommended to me, that if it is a chip failing, like your time-based corrector, it's likely an aging capacitor issue. He said, have a fan in one hand, a hairdryer in the other, and regulate the temperature.
Wow.
Was their solution. And there was actually a YouTube guy I consulted as well, who this guy in the UK who has a channel. I can't remember it, but I'll see if I can provide you the link afterwards. But he does a whole YouTube channel about repairing these things, and I actually emailed him and he gave me his advice. And when I finally got it working, as a courtesy, I said, hey, I finally got it working. This is what I did. He goes, that's excellent. It's great news. So those other dicks, you wouldn't mind sending me some parts, right? So yeah.
You know, it's tempting to say that this is a problem unique to analog video. You know, things got a little crazy in the 90s, a lot of different formats. Eventually the kings emerged from the pile. But, you know, this isn't unique to that. It actually applies to all kinds of things in game development. So, mm-hmm. You know, for example, here at the VGHF, we've got game source code backups on at least 6 or 7 tape formats. Some of them are really obscure. And you know, like the M2, the hardware is kind of failing us and disappearing. And at least in one case, I don't really want to talk about it, even ate a tape, which I'm not thrilled about.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, though, that you mentioned that the whole analog thing, digital was not free from this deterioration either. One of the formats that we heavily recorded, particularly the sound design and music on, was DAT. Mm-hmm. And the DAT tapes, you know, was, you know, DAT is digital audio tape. And of course, everyone thinks, oh, it's digital, be fine. But the trouble with digital, if an analog tape goes sour, there's enough data there to provide you at least something. You may get some snow on the image or some horizontal shifting or some glitching or a color wash issue. With digital, the minute a section of that tape goes and those ones and zeros scramble, that's it. Like, there is no recoverable data for that portion. So thankfully, 95% of the DAT tapes from the studio sessions for the audio and music for the games were preserved. But on a small handful of these tapes, they play fine. And then as soon as they start to glitch, you're talking audio artifacts like crazy, like completely unrecoverable. Whereas an analog tape may be like, oh, there's a bit of snow here and that's it. We can fix that.
Right. Or even, you know, theoretically, you could go in frame by frame and fix up the errors, as opposed to digitally, where it's just like, this data doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
So were you able to recover, you know, the original source code and stuff like that? Or is that gone?
Well, okay, so the interesting thing about the source code is a lot of the Tex Murphy games, their engines and platforms was written all in assembly language.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going sort of some way low level stuff here.
Not super helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So machine language on old 8 and 16-bit machines is not going to be much use. So I couldn't have an answer for you with regards to whether or not the source code from those original games had lived on. But I will say that, you know, from your assets perspective, like your 3D models, textures, images, etc.,
yeah,
they have actually lived on because those were archived to CD. And so there was probably about 3 or 4, maybe 5 spools, 50 tall, of just assets spread over these CDs. And in particular, a lot of it was 3D files from the level designs from 3D Studio back before it had the word Max in the title. So some really old...
3D Studio Min, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So 3D Studio Zero. So, you know, exactly. And it was like, you know, those were well preserved. I mean, source code, there's not a lot we'll be able to do with the assembly language in the first place.
Right, but I mean, it's to be fair, it's a fairly simple set of logic, right? That you know, you don't need to probably refer to source to know, you know, what happens when you try to use this item on this item.
Right, play this scene.
It's observable.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you, okay, so there's 50, there's like several spools of 50 CDs. Have those all been digitized now too? Is that part of the job you're working on?
I sure as hell hope so, because
oh no.
Do you need to borrow some equipment?
You need to borrow one of our CD robots.
Yeah, that would be absolutely fantastic, because like so I had like I had also grabbed all the spools. They were also part of the you know, office tour, where I grabbed everything I possibly could, and I grabbed the spools and I put them in my office. Now, I just did a very sort of, you know, early pass of just putting them in the CD drive and making sure a good handful of them hadn't deteriorated or gotten moldy, because, you know, CDs are another digital format that faces the wrath of deterioration, especially when stored incorrectly.
Right. It's not just magnetic media.
Yeah, CDs exactly.
Rot too.
So one of the huge advantages of living in Salt Lake City here is just how dry the Utah environment is. It's probably the best place in the entire country for this content to survive, even when ill cared for. I mean, you know, imagine if we were in Florida or something like that. He's like, forget it. So when I sort of had those spools in my office, I checked about 10 of them, and we had 100% success rate for readable data on those disks. And so I kind of shelved it, so to speak. And it wasn't until we started approaching this remaster for the game that Doug, who was the original level designer, said, you know, I want to sort of dig back into the archives and start building these levels. So he grabbed the spools back off me and started copying this data over disk by disk, but only the disks he needed. So he said, you know, I'm building this level, so I'm going to look through the labels on the disk. Okay, I found it on disk 48, pop that disk in, copy it off, and then put it away. So he hasn't done an exhaustive digitization of it, but he has... related to our project. And I'm like, no, that's got to change. We need to be exhaustive.
That's good, but it's almost worse in a way, because then it's like, okay, what has been done, what hasn't been done? You almost have to start over at that point.
Precisely. And that's exactly what we're going to do. Just like start over.
Well, the device you want is called the NIMBY USB, NIMBIE.
We bought the last existing ones.
That's not true.
I thought we bought the last used ones, because they're not selling them new anymore.
They are right now. So I think at the time, we might have gotten maybe the last one. But
NIMBY USB, I have written that down.
So it is, we own 6 of these, I think. Yeah. It is,
I think,
essentially
one's on loan right now, but
that's true. It's one is in Minneapolis currently, but it will come home. It's essentially a top loading hopper attached to a USB DVD drive, and it loads and unloads one at a time. And you could stack up to 50 in there, which is conveniently the size of your spindles. And you can just set it and forget it, and it'll archive all 50 of those discs for you.
That sounds beautiful. Thank you for the suggestion. I am definitely going to add that to the list and say, we need to get this now.
And we're keeping that in the show, because that might be useful to some people.
Yeah,
currently on sale, quote unquote, for $760, but well worth it for a project like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's just about as much as your time to just sit there and switch it manually at that stage.
Oh, my time is worth way more than that, honey. That's really all I had other than
I wanted to talk a little bit about the AI part of this as well.
Sure.
I mean, this is so you've digitized all the stuff, but then actually making these look nice now is a whole other adventure, right?
Yeah, I mean, so if we had approached this maybe like 6 months ago, we still wouldn't have been satisfied with the output of machine learning. Because as I mentioned, before we started, you know, it's with AI upscaling, for as good as it is, it's always a case of garbage in, garbage out. And it's very specific about the type of source material you provide to yield an excellent result. And where it really struggles is dealing with the type of content synonymous with tapes, and that is interlaced content. Because interlacing is great when you have a precise measure of your A frames and your B frames. However, when you digitize from these formats onto your computer, whether or not you use a lossy format like an MPEG or something, the odds of ensuring that the lines in the interlaced fields are perfect one-to-one match, some of that can be lost in that archival compression. And so you need something that can handle that very well. And for the longest time, AI upscaling algorithms didn't really take into account interlacing. So you had to deinterlace it in advance and then run it through the algorithms. And when I did a test about 6 months ago, the results were good. Like, they were better, but it was like, it still left a lot to be desired. And then about 2 months ago, one of the tools that I use received an update where they said, hey, guess what? We now have an algorithm that can handle interlaced content. So I got the update and I plugged in the first piece of content, and the results were absolutely phenomenal, like just mind-blowingly good. We were able to up-res to 4K and have it look like it was shot just yesterday, you know, in the original studio. And it just looked absolutely beautiful. And one of the really cool things that we were able to do about the algorithm to tweak to our advantage is, as video games are getting more and more, becoming presented on more and more modern hardware, modern consoles, modern PCs, there is a huge reliance for video games, especially when it comes to motion sickness and accessibility, to present things in a higher rate. So 60 hertz, 120 hertz is a much more pleasant experience.
On modern displays, right? Because what we don't have anymore are essentially, this is maybe getting a little too nerdy, but like, if you've ever noticed that an old game just doesn't look as smooth as you remember, even if you're using an emulator or modern, you know, upscalers or whatever.
Yeah,
that's because if you were playing on a CRT back in the day, after every frame, the entire screen would go black so fast that you don't even see it. And then it would start drawing again. And that actually tricks your brain into seeing some smoothness that isn't otherwise there. We don't have that anymore. So it is actually important to make things as smooth as possible today, because essentially even like a 60 frame rate now just does not look as smooth on a modern display as it did back then.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's one of the reasons why I keep a CRT around for old legacy consoles and games like that, because it's the real way to play it. It's like vinyl. It's preserved a certain way, and you need the right preserved hardware to play it to that full experience. And so one of the biggest fears we had, even with upscaling this content, is a lot of it was filmed at either 24 frames a second or 30 frames a second if it was to tape. And our concern was going to be, if we were going to remaster this game and have it in a modern engine and have it capable of displaying at a rate of frames that was, you know, in excess of 60, 120, 240, even more, because, you know, you don't really cap a frame rate for your exploratory environments. Our concern was, you have a player walking around this environment at 120 hertz. It's really smooth. And then you cut to this video that's shot at 24 or 30 frames a second. It's going to be very jarring and take you out of it. Whereas back then, the frame rate of the game was so poor that the video was actually a reprieve, even though it was presented at 10 frames a second. So it was kind of matched up perfectly, but now we had concerns. So what we did with the algorithm was we noticed how the AI upscaler was working for the interlaced frames was it was taking the A field, which is 50% of the vertical data, and it was using artificial intelligence to fill in every second line of the field and discarding the B field completely. So you had 30 frames a second in, 30 frames a second out. And it looked absolutely fantastic. But then I looked at it and said, no. Don't discard the B field. I want you to convert the B field as well. So when we got it to do that, the end result was we had an interlaced 30 frames a second source converted to an ultra high definition progressive 60 frames a second output.
And so I want to make sure that I understand this, because sure. If I don't, I think a lot of listeners aren't either. So interlaced signal, first of all, just the most basic primer on that. So a television back in the day, a CRT television, if you were watching, say, broadcast television, it would essentially draw every other line of the image and then quickly start over and draw, you know, what was previously a blank image. And if you were to watch, you know, a DVD on a CRT today, you probably would even notice that an image is kind of shimmering a little bit. And that's just because of that interlaced signal. And so what it sounds like you're saying is that, and then essentially you would get 30 frames a second, right? Because even though it is sort of playing, even though there are essentially 60 half frames, it's blending them so that it appears as 30. But what you're doing with AI upscaling is for every one of those half frames, you are with AI filling in those blank lines. And then what you're saying is essentially you're doing that now for the A and B frames. So you're almost inheriting, you know, double the frame rate for free.
Yes, exactly. And it was fantastic because, you know, to have that data, you know, the jury is still out on how beneficial interlacing was. I just know that anyone who worked in the content, interlacing was never pleasant to work with, especially for fast motion, because if you had something that went across the screen particularly quickly, mm-hmm. and you had your A field and then your B field, which was, you know, 1/60th of a second afterwards, you'd have this weird combing effect on the edge of the image. And it was primarily a bandwidth issue, a broadcasting bandwidth issue. They couldn't present progressive frames over the air, so they gave you half the resolution, presented at twice the speed, exactly as you described. But yeah, we basically got free frames out of our content thanks to AI upscaling, because there was enough data in the A field to fill in those blanks, and subsequently enough data in the B field to convert these half frames into full frames and double our frame rate.
And I encourage anyone listening to look at this article, if for no other reason than to see the really good illustrations of this, because, you know, that was a wonderful explanation, but I definitely needed the visual to go along with it to fully understand it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, don't rely on me tripping over my words explaining how an interlaced signal works. Go look at a visual aid. It's actually it's not as hard to understand as it sounds. It's actually very simple. But this had never even occurred to me. I don't. Maybe this is a common thing, you know, in the video enthusiast community, but it hadn't occurred to me until reading this that, like, oh, duh, you know, this was, we did film things at 60 FPS, actually, but it's just that it was 60 half frames a second.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, are we talking 60 frames, 60 hertz? I mean, there were so many terminologies used to describe it. You know, it is confusing.
But it's just interesting to me that it's like, oh, we could actually, like, do this to any interlaced signal and it... And, you know, it might not work on some things, like you get the sort of what we used to call the soap opera effect on shows where things just looked a little too smooth. But
yes.
It might be an interesting way to remaster footage outside of this game, even.
Well, one of the challenges as well with regards to working with green screen and blue screen footage is it's actually it yielded a very interesting result in our situation, because when you have a full frame of information, that is no blue screen, you've got, you know, your background, your foreground and everything, just general footage. The AI algorithm has enough of an understanding based on its database to accurately find the edge of an actor, know where the actor finishes and your background begins. So it can pull its data for that. The trouble with blue screen and green screen, and this will be interesting for anyone who's considering upscaling old chroma key content, is the AI algorithms aren't so savvy when it comes to finding where an actor ends and then seeing nothing but a plain blue or green color behind them.
That's so interesting, because I would feel like it would be the opposite. Like, that feels like a much cleaner cut.
Well, I would think it's all dependent on what the AI is trained on, right? Like,
right.
What its sample set is, and if you know, people aren't training it on chroma key scenes, you know, what the AI is going to try to do, I would think, you tell me, Matt, is try to like create a reality that isn't there, is try to like create some background elements.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if you have an actor wave his hand in front of the screen, you know, in your original interlaced content, you're going to get that combing issue. Now, when your AI algorithm takes your A field and it says, okay, I need to fill in every blank in between the lines in this field, it will do so very well on top of the actor himself. So, for example, the tie that he's wearing around his neck, it'll say, there's data here, I'll replicate that the line below, and then there's data on the next line, I'll replicate that the line below. But when it's moving in front of the blue screen and it sees in between those fields there's this bright chroma key blue, it tends to be like, okay, there's enough data in the palm of the hand for me to fill that in and replace the blue, but where his fingers is slightly blurry and I can see that there may be some background around
that's
the
a dog.
Yeah. It doesn't so much glitch out, but it does kind of keep a little bit of the blue in there. So we have an issue with our chroma key that there's still around the edge of these things where the algorithm's just like, I give up. You're getting blue. I don't care.
So you just get some like blue bleeding into the hands. And
yeah, it's like this subtle blue comb fringing on the edges, because there's no background for it to say, hey, in absence of data on the edge of this finger, I see that you're in a forest, so I'm going to put a forest behind this. It's looking at the background and going, okay, there's blue, there's blue, there's blue, there's blue.
What's
you're
a blue,
blue
environment?
Yeah, exactly.
You're an avatar now.
Exactly. And who knows, maybe in 10 years' time, the algorithms will be trained on that content too. And that's the downside. It's like with anything, upgrading computers, anything, you'll spend your time, because you got to pull the trigger at a certain point. You got to say the technology has evolved. We need to do this now. And then we'll probably release the game and they'll say, hey, new algorithm. We'll support
Well, I was
chroma
about
key.
To say, by the time you're done rendering, because it's still rendering, right?
It actually just finished this morning. The machine literally, it was rendering, it was processing the AI upscaling for 6.5 weeks straight.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Going through all the tapes. And this morning, literally, couldn't have been better timing. It literally said, we're done.
Well, I was about to joke that by the time it's done rendering, the technique will have advanced and you'll get a better picture. But probably
not. Oh, I did that. The first thing I did, as soon as it finished rendering, I said, check for updates. And thankfully, there weren't any that came through. Because if it did, it said, we've updated the algorithm, it'd be like, oh.
Okay, but this is inevitable. And this is why, folks. No matter how nice your re-rendered version of something is, that source material, you need to preserve it as it was as much as possible. I mean, you keep those tapes in boxes because reading those might get better. You keep the raw digitization of the tapes because the upscaling is going
to
get better.
But also don't wait for it to get better to do
no,
it.
No.
Do it now.
Just do it, yeah.
But
especially
also
if you're releasing a
stuff.
Commercial project.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what comes next now? I saw, you know, that you're now putting these things together is not a simple task, because you don't have it's not like you just play these tapes from start to finish and that's the game. You know, there's kind of mapping that goes into this, and you found a really interesting artifact that's going to help you with that.
Yeah, so the original game, because when they were edited together, the idea of a non-linear edit suite for video was only really accessible for really high-end studios. Back then, it was very much linear editing. So the director, Adrian Carr, who came on board for the Pandora Directive, he edited the entire full motion video sequences for the game on what's considered the paper edit process. So he had like oodles and oodles of grid paper, and they would send him over the dailies or the weeklies on tape with little time codes along the bottom of them. And he would sit there with his grid paper and mark down the punch in and punch out points of the edits, because he was in LA. And of course, remote networking was not a thing there as well, because there wasn't much, if any, internet at the time. And so they'd send him the tapes, he'd put it in his machine, he'd note down the time codes and say, punch in here, punch out there. Spend hours doing that. Then he'd send these documents back to the studio, and they would then punch in his information to the computer, and that would then spit out these takes based on these time codes. So it was a paper edit process that was painstaking but extremely effective at the time for remote working. Nowadays, we can just dump the tapes into, you know, Adobe Premiere and just, you know, do the non-linear editing process. But the benefit of this document, and we found his folder, it's about probably 4 or 5 inches thick of just grid paper of time codes, in points, out points, labels, and everything. We can use that to find the general time codes of what we're looking for and perform as close as we can to a match edit of the original content as a basis for the new game's edited full motion video. And then maybe explore the idea of a director's cut by choosing alternative takes, more emotive angles, corrected perspectives, that kind of thing.
Blooper reel.
Exactly. Oh, and there's a lot of them.
Well, that's incredible. This is just such a fascinating story that I'm glad we got to shed some light on, because I think, you know, when you see a game coming out as a remaster or whatever, I mean, this is sometimes the work that goes into it is someone was able to find all of the tapes over a period of many years and go through an adventure to save all of them. And I mean, only then was this even really a possibility. So I think that's, we want to see more of this in the world, but man, is it thankless work that more game companies need to be paying for.
Yeah. Well, and also game companies need to stop moving and throwing stuff away.
Yeah. Just never move.
Or at least call us. Just call us. Just call
us. Yeah, that works too.
We don't have a phone number, but email us.
Well, it was funny that you said, you know, before that, you know, some companies, you know, like the Command & Conquer, et cetera. I also heard that, you know, Sierra is having a very hard time with their games as well, because a lot of their content made it to the trash as well, which is really sad, because that was some of my favorite games. You guys are smiling. I know there's a story here.
Not one we can tell yet, but go on.
But there's a lot of difficulty there, but it was funny, because just going back to this whole getting in there and getting your hands dirty, I really enjoy the fact that you guys are encouraging this in the industry, because what a lot of people don't realize is it does open doors to remasters, and remasters are in at the moment, like, because you have people, a new generation coming up who are enjoying games, and then you've of course got the you know, the fist-shaking older generation saying, well, let me tell you about really good games. And the only way to present these to the new generations is through these remasters, because, you know, we all have nostalgia goggles on. As much as I want to sit someone younger down and say, you're going to play this game because it's brilliant, they're not going to get over the lower resolution or the lower color palette or the slower frame rate or the janky controls. They want to experience it new, and this opens so many doors. And it was actually funny, because when Access Software was bought by Microsoft, everyone moved to one of the Microsoft studios along with all these tapes, which were stored in some janky warehouse at Microsoft. And it was when that the company was dissolved and no longer part of Microsoft, the staff has basically said, we're closing down these studios, come and get everything you can, because tomorrow morning, everything is going in the dumpster. And that's when Doug sprung into action and said, we need to go in after hours and just load everything we can into a truck and just get the hell out of here. Because even Microsoft, you know, was going to just basically trash everything. Like, no questions asked. If I see a box, we're going to trash it. And unfortunately, it's usually not any one individual's fault. It's sometimes these companies just go in and clean house. And by the time people realize it, it's already too late.
Oh, yeah. How many people have we talked to, Kelsey, with that
story?
Oh,
yeah. Well, and some companies that you would be really sad to hear have been dumping things, too.
All of them have been dumping things. Yes. No one's immune.
I mean, this story has so many... a special shout out to Dave Brown as well.
From the software, yeah, because he was also responsible for ensuring that these tapes didn't fall by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, this story has so many heroes, and it could have gone wrong at so many points. So the fact that it was all recoverable is, I mean, to me, quite literally a miracle. Like,
I'm sad about Underkilling Moon, though. I am so sad about Underkilling Moon. I still hope, I still every now and again, and this is a true story, I will walk around that warehouse and poke around corners in the hopes that maybe the box wasn't thrown out and it was just stuffed in a chest somewhere hidden.
Oh, don't leave us with that sad image.
This is a happy ending by all accounts. This is really a happy ending.
No, it is. It is. And like I said, we were able to digitize Underkilling Moon before they were trashed.
All the tapes that are gone were digitized. I mean, just not perfectly, but enough to be better.
Yes, precisely.
Well, Matt, this was awesome. Thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. Where can people find you and Tex on the internet?
Of course. Well, of course, you know, bigfinishgames.com, the ones that were responsible for the Tex Murphy series, as well as producing the Pandora Directive 25th Anniversary Remake and Remaster. So that is, you know, related to this entire project. I myself, you know, I'm sure there'll be links posted related to the blog. I'm available on social media as well. I'm also a musician goes by the name of Chrono Wolf as well. So I do video game music. So if you're interested in checking any of that out, that's all there. But first and foremost, this is all about Tex Murphy and video game content. So please check it out. And as you mentioned, you know, we are publishing a blog fairly frequently about the entire process related to this archival of content.
Got our attention. Maybe it'll get yours. Matt, thank you again. This is great.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.